Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello, and welcome to episode 64 of Dogcast Radio. Today, we have an interview with Ted Carasotti, author of Merle's Door.
I soon learned that he would want to go out at 11 o'clock at night, midnight, 2 in the morning. He kept his own schedule, and I would have to get out of bed to let him in and out. And it was then that I hit upon the idea of why not give him his own dog door so we could have lives independent of each other, kind of like partners that keep their own schedule.
Plus, we were contacted by a listener concerned about beagles in the UK since the ban on hunting with dogs.
They don't hunt live quarry anymore. They hunt a false scent. It's called drag hunting.
But before all that, we have the Dogcast Radio News.
Hello and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. Breed-specific legislation causes strong feeling, with many people holding the opinion that a dog should be judged as an individual rather than just an example of a breed. One dog in a Connecticut shelter has found out just what an individual she is after suffering from breed prejudice for several months. Apparently, Mindy resembles a pit bull terrier, and as a consequence, she has not been adopted despite being a lovely dog. Volunteers at the shelter clubbed together to raise the $200 necessary to have Mindy DNA tested to establish what breed she is. In fact, she is a mix of boxer, bull terrier, English cocker spaniel, and bulldog, and the shelter hopes she will now find it easier to find a home.
The potential pitfalls and dangers of commercial dog food have been highlighted in the past couple of years, but now it seems there's a new problem. In South Carolina, a tractor trailer exiting the I-77 turned over, spilling its load of dog food and blocking the exit road.
Is that the first case of dog food stopping traffic? Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, a schoolboy has been stopped from taking his assistance dog into school. We heard in the last episode of Dogcast Radio that 2008 is the year of the assistance dog, and that these dogs have the legal right to access public places. Despite all this, 7-year-old Bradley Delator's school has said his autism assistance dog cannot enter the building, as some children are allergic to it or afraid of it. Apparently, officials have stated that they would also refuse access to a guide dog. Bradley's parents are taking legal action in a bid to sort the matter out.
In another US state, Maryland Area Guide Dog Users, Inc., was highlighting how guide dog users and the police need to work together to ensure blind and partially sighted people get proper access to emergency services. For example, police officers may be reluctant to enter a home with a loose guide dog inside, while blind people need the information necessary to establish whether the visitor is a genuine police officer. To help facilitate understanding and cooperation, the organisation is running a number of partnerships with law enforcement conferences during the year.
And staying in America, our final item is news of a dog that took on orphaned puppies and saved their lives. When Amy Roberts' boxer Layla died only a day after giving birth to 8 pups, Amy despaired for the tiny dogs. She did some research and attempted to bottle feed the puppies, but one died and the rest were becoming weaker. Then a family member put her in touch with a breeder who had a dog whose litter had just been weaned. In an amazing display of maternal kindness, the dog in question, Maddie, a black Labrador, was willing to let the pups feed from her. Now the orphaned litter are thriving, and Maddie seems happy too.
Well, I guess that's what you call puppy love. And that's all from us on the Dogcast Radio News Desk. Goodbye.
One dog barks at something, and 100 bark at his sound. Chinese proverb. Have you read Merle's Door by Ted Carasotti? If you haven't, you've really missed out on a treat. This book is the story of Merle's life. It's the story of his relationship with Ted, and it's so much more than that. The book contains a wealth of fascinating research, and not only will it make you laugh and cry, it will educate you and probably make you re-examine your attitude to your dog. But let's start at the beginning. Just how did Ted and Merle meet?
It was April 1991, and I was traveling from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, to southern Utah to begin a river trip with four friends. And we drove up to the put-in on the river, on the San Juan River, at about 11:30 at night, and in my headlights there appeared this big golden dog panting, his front paws tapping the ground in a little dance. And as we opened the doors to our cars, he did a sniff, that searching sniff that dogs do, raising their snouts and reading, as I like to call it, the books of their world. And he came right to my door, leaned his head forward cautiously, sniffed at my bare thigh, and looked up into my eyes with this luminous expression that said, "You need a dog, and I'm it." And I had been looking for a dog for over 15 months. I had been looking at Labrador Retriever litters and Samoyed litters, thinking that those dogs could share my life in the outdoors. But no pup had given me that undeniable heart tug that said, we are a team. But Merle did. Merle had a quiet, collected air. He seemed very finished and competent. He looked like he'd been surviving out there on his own, and he made a little bed next to my sleeping bag when I threw it down under some cottonwood trees. He was there in the morning, and we took him down the river, and for 5 days he swam between the kayaks, and just seemed like a wonderful companion. So I brought him back to Wyoming and gave him his own dog door so he could come and go as he wished, and we spent 13 and a half years together.
I was going to say about the dog door. When he came to live with you, he still had a very high degree of independence. So can you tell us about the dog door?
Well, at first he didn't have a dog door. I opened the door for him, and he would go out, spend some hours outside. And I need to back up and say that we lived, and I still live, in the village of Kelly, which has about 100 people in it, and it's within Grand Teton National Park. It's a bit of private land called an inholding, and it's surrounded by millions of acres of wilderness. And Merle was raised, I believe, in the desert in Utah, in millions of acres of wilderness. So he had these very consummate survival skills about wildlife. He knew about rattlesnakes, and he quickly learned which big animals he needed to avoid. But I soon learned that he would want to go out at 11 o'clock at night, midnight, 2 in the morning. He kept his own schedule, and I would have to get out of bed to let him in and out. And it was then that I hit upon the idea of, why not give him his own dog door so we could have lives independent of each other, kind of like partners that keep their own schedule. And so I installed the dog door. He thought it was a total triumph. And he could then do his rounds through Kelly. And that's the way we lived. We'd get up in the morning, and he would take off through the dog door, and I'd go to my office. And a few hours later, I'd hear the double slap of the dog door, because there were two of them, one in the front door, then there's an Arctic entry in a mudroom, and then another dog door in the door to the great room. And he'd pat into the office and say, "Oh, still working? You know, there are a lot of interesting things going on out there. You should come out." And I'd say, "Well, maybe in a few hours. I've got a lot of work." And he'd drink some water, go back out. I'd see him continue his second circumambulation of the village, and then he'd come back, and probably in the afternoon we'd go out and take a hike or a ski or a bike ride together. So thus we kept our own schedules.
Mm-hmm. I mean, indeed, he goes and does his, you know, as you say, his rounds of the village so much. He became known as the Mayor of Kelly, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And he had all his both dog and human friends that he would visit and do a big circle around the village, get dog biscuits, sing with one of the songwriters who was composing on his steps in front of his house, take walks with other dogs, visit in people's homes, and I'd come back, and he'd be carrying this for a whole array of different smells, perfume, cigarette smoke, fried food, depending on which house he had been spending some time in. And even to this day, I get emails from people who say, "You don't know me, but I read your book, I liked it, and I want to tell you that I met Merle way down on the Grovant River. I was painting one day on my easel, and he came by and said hi. Or I was skiing up in the Grovant Mountains and met Merle, and he led me around the trails for 2 hours." And so Merle very much had a life of his own.
Yeah, yeah. Now, he not only interacted with people very well. As you say, he had his dog friends. There's also Grey Cat, who came to live with you. There's horses, there's llamas, and there's an incredible variety of wildlife. I mean, there's the scenes that you describe of him smelling things, him pointing out tracks to you, your interaction with coyotes, you know, once he's settled his scores with them. And one of the things that I imagine will surprise a lot of people is that what would be interpreted as disobedience, perhaps by some people, you realizes him, you know, you're calling him to you, and he's saying, no, you come and look at this. And he pointed out a lot of things to you, didn't he?
Right. And when we live in a household with people, sometimes we'll say, "Hey, come see this a moment. Come see this TV program, or read this article in the paper." And the person will say, "I'll be a minute. I'm busy. I'm doing something that really interests me. And by the way, you ought to come over here and see this." Well, that's how Merle and I live. Most of the time when I'd say, "Merle, come," he'd come. But when we'd be outside and he would be smelling something that was of a great deal of interest to him, say grizzly bear scat or wolf scat, he'd give me this look that would say, just as you pointed out, "It is you, my friend, not I, who should come over here and see what I'm smelling, because I think it would interest you." And Merle, having spent many years with me, knew what interested me, because we'd spend time looking at wolves and looking at grizzly bears, tracking elk. And when he would find that kind of scat, I figured he knew that I would be interested in it, and he would look at me up at me from a distance with this very eager expression, wagging his tail, and say, "Come on over here. I shouldn't come right now." And I think this, all dogs have the opportunity to do that if they spend some off-leash time. They get to read the smells of their world, just the way we get to read the books of our world. And very often, especially in wild places, they can show us things that we will have walked by, since our senses are not quite as acute as theirs.
Mm-hmm. You give many instances in the book of Merle's ability to express himself. One that really struck home with me and sort of really made me smile, and I can imagine it, is when you're out with him and Brower at the river, and Brower mm-hmm. is happily fetching. Can you tell us what Merle's reaction to that was?
Well, Merle never liked to fetch. The first 4 years of his life, he disdained it. I would throw him a ball or a stick, and he would look at me with a look that said, "That's for dogs. I don't do that." And no matter how many people tried to cajole him with treats or teach him to retrieve with retriever dummies, even though he had this obvious Labrador heritage, he just wouldn't do it. However, Brower, whom he met as a pup, a young pup, he was my then girlfriend's dog, and Brower and Merle grew up together, and Brower treated Merle very much like an uncle, and Merle treated Brower like a young protege, taking him around Kelly. Well, Brower had no inhibitions about retrieving and would jump in the Grovant River whenever I threw a stick for him. Well, about the fourth or fifth time we had a walk along the river, and Brower had retrieved the stick, Merle sat down in front of me with this eager look, shaking his shoulders, saying, "I can do that." And I said, "Are you really going to retrieve?" He shook in readiness, and I threw the stick in the water, and he jumped in the river, classic form, swam down the river, got the stick, brought it up to me, threw it at my feet with a nonchalant toss of his head. I said, "I am stunned, sir. What gives?" He goes, "Ha, ha, ha, no big deal," with his little pant. So I threw it again. He retrieved it again. I threw it a third time, and he actually looked at me with disappointment. He sighed, and very slowly he walked into the river, got the stick, brought it to me, and threw it at my feet with this toss of his head that indicated, "Enough of this nonsense. I showed you I could do it." So I picked up the stick, threw it again, and he simply watched it float away. And I said, "Go get it, fetch." And he gave me one of the most revealing expressions I've ever seen on a dog. His head was cocked to the side with wry indulgence, and he looked up into my eyes with this tender reproach that said, "I showed you I can do this, but it's simply not my game." And I was certain that he wanted to show me that his stand on retrieving was not a lack of proficiency, but simply a lack of desire. He just didn't want to do this.
You give a couple of examples of sort of how Merle had a sense of self. One is very early on in the book where he's just joined you on the raft. And then there's the mirror later on. But, you know, those do seem to indicate he did understand that's the sound of me, that's the sight of me.
Yes. the first time was literally the morning after we had met. And we were floating down the river, and he looked back to where we had left and gave this start. "My God, the campground has disappeared. I'm in new country." He looked around apprehensively and gave this mournful howl, and immediately an echo rebounded from the canyon walls in which we were now floating through. And he looked around, almost crouching, wondering where this strange dog was howling from. So he howled again. The echo responded. He looked around again. He howled a third time. His voice rebounded, and then this look of dawning realization crossed his face that it was actually his voice. It sounded, his voice went out, this voice came back, and it sounded like him, and he howled again, this time not apprehensively, but as a test. And at the instant his voice came back to him, he began beating his tail happily, and he looked at me with an expression that said, "That's me." The other time was when we had walked into a sports therapist whom I was seeing for my back, and she had a studio with a whole wall that was mirrored. And as we walked in, Merle looked over and stopped dead and saw, "Wow, there's a dog, and there's Ted." Well, who could that dog be with Ted? He looked at me, he looked at the mirror, he looked at Jen, he looked at the mirror, there was Jen. And I raised my hand in the mirror. He looked at me. He looked at the mirror. And he leaned forward, began to wag his tail, and the dog wagged his tail. And he just sat down with this utter look of realization that the dog was he. And he walked over to the mirror, lay down in front of it, and started studying himself in profile, lifting his chin. And from that moment on, whenever we went to Jen's, he would greet her and then walk in front of the mirror, lie down, and look at himself. I had a full-length mirror in my bedroom that he had never paid any attention to his reflection in, just the way most dogs do not pay attention to their reflections. But after the incident with Jen, he walked up into the bedroom, walked over to himself in the mirror, wagged his tail, just look, and he looked up at me with an expression that said, "Yep, I get it. That's me."
At other times in the book, and I'd like to address this because I think this will, for a British audience at least, you know, I think it would be useful to address this because there's a couple of times where, for various safety reasons or health reasons, you have to use once a choke collar, once a shock collar.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we talk about that, please?
You bet. The first time was when we had arrived back here in Wyoming, and Merle loved to chase cattle. He chased cattle on the San Juan River, and by his behavior with him, I was pretty sure that as a dog on the San Juan River, he had killed young calves, and that's one of the ways he survived there. So we get back here, he starts to chase cattle, and he was not going to survive here. If he did that, he would be shot by a rancher. Mm. And I simply didn't know how to stop him chasing cattle and also let him be a free-roaming dog. I mean, it'd be easy. Just fence him, keep him leashed up, no more cattle-chasing problem. So I thought, well, you can often break a dog of chasing cars by riding in the car and throwing a bucket of cold water on the dog from the window when it chases the car. And I couldn't figure out how to ride a cow and do that. So some people suggested using a choke collar, these days often called a training collar. The monks of Newskeet, if British readers are familiar with those fellows in New York who train German shepherds, use those sorts of leather training collars on their pups and give them leash corrections. So I took Merle out on a bike ride, had about 50 feet of climbing, light climbing rope attached to his choke or training collar, and when he started chasing cattle, I snubbed him, and I only had to do this 3 times, yelling no, and he never chased cattle again. He was a very quick study in that respect. The other incident that you mentioned was when Merle, later in his life, began to put on weight, and I discovered that a woman across the field from us was feeding him all sorts of filet mignon stuffed with roquefort cheese and chicken breasts and who knows what else from the restaurant in which she worked. And I couldn't figure out a way to use positive reinforcement to change Merle's behavior. I'd go over there with my hiking boots or my bike and say, let's go for a hike, and give him a biscuit as soon as he came to the car, and off we'd go. And the next day, he'd be right back there sitting on our doorstep. Mm. So I resorted to a shock collar, even though I didn't want to do it, and shocked him a few times when I found him over there. And that finally cured him of going over and eating at Lucille's. And I guess the point being that at some point, some degree of adverse conditioning of punishment may be necessary to keep your dog safe and healthy. And, of course, I need to back up and say that's presupposing that you want a free-roaming dog, because if you keep your dog in the house all the time or on a leash or in a fenced yard, this is not going to be a problem. But I couldn't imagine doing that to an individual such as Merle, who so relished his freedom, and his freedom created this amazing individual who knew so much about the world and had such a great deal of intelligence because of his wide-ranging canine education, if you will.
Merle's Door is really a great read, and we'll be hearing more from author Ted Carasotti later in the show. The greatest love is a mother's, then a dog's, then a sweetheart's. Polish proverb.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
One of our listeners, who's a big beagle fan, emailed wanting to know if the ban on hunting with dogs in the UK had had an impact on the beagle population here.
Well, really, it hasn't had an impact,
yeah,
because the hunt packs are still going.
Yeah. So how are they functioning?
Well, they're putting down a false trail, like an aniseed trail, and they're following the aniseed trail, the same as the foxhounds. They don't hunt live quarry anymore.
Yeah.
They hunt a false scent, and they go out with that.
Yeah.
It's called drag hunting.
Yeah. So has that, involved sort of retraining them to follow a different scent?
Well, it's caused the major foxhound hunts quite a lot of problems to retrain their dogs. But the beagles took to it. And what a lot of the hunt kennels did was put the scent of a dead animal and mixed it with the aniseed to get them to follow the scents.
And then gradually do you sort of wean the dead animal smell out? And
yes,
less...
yeah, they wean it out and they hunt the false. They usually have someone on a motorbike or one of these buggy cart things, and they go in front and then so far in front, and then the hounds follow it.
So
hunt meetings are still very well supported.
So there's no need to worry about beagles finding themselves without a home in that way?
Not at the moment, no.
No.
Oh, no, not at the moment. They're fine.
That's great. Okay. If we can move on to sort of talk about the beagle, sort of a breed profile. Bearing in mind we're radio, can you sort of describe the appearance of a beagle?
The beagle is a merry little hound. It's a small hound. It should be no smaller than 13 inches and no taller than 16 at the withers.
That's the shoulder, is it?
That's the shoulder, yes, the top of the shoulder. They're a compact little hound, very smart. And they come in, there's 14 different colours of hounds, but please don't ask me to quote them all.
And what's the coat like?
The coat is like a double coat. There's a harsher coat, although it feels soft on the top, and then there's a softer coat underneath, which is the waterproof coat.
And does that coat take much grooming?
No. You'd be surprised with what you can do with a damp chamois and a piece of kitchen roll.
And presumably if you do that, will there be much shedding or not?
They do shed. They shed more, twice a year they'll have a shed, a real good shed. And a bitch that's had a litter will have a good shed. But that's all to do with hormones. But they will lose hair all the time. If you don't want to get covered in hairs, don't wear black or navy blue.
No. Okay, so what's it like to live with a beagle? What's one like as a pet dog in your house?
Living with a beagle is like living with a four-year-old child that's got a Mr. Nobody in the cupboard that does everything naughty, and it doesn't do anything naughty. Although it's standing there looking at you with its gorgeous big brown eyes, wagging its tail, and the post hanging out of its mouth.
Saying, I didn't chew it.
I didn't chew it, no. It wasn't me.
So they can be quite mischievous.
Oh, they can be most mischievous. They are absolutely gorgeous, loving and gentle. But they can be naughty.
So is that just from the merry hound, or is it that they get bored? Where does that come from?
Well, if a beagle is left alone for too many hours, then yes, they get bored and they get destructive. And they can be very destructive. But a lot of it is the temperament of the beagle. I'm a happy little fellow, and I'm here, I'm the centre of attention. They do have selective deafness, definitely. They don't always want to do what you want them to do, but you, in a nice, kind way, you have to be the leader.
Yes.
Because they are a pack animal, and you have to be the leader. You know what I mean?
Saying that they are a pack animal, are they happy living on their own as the only dog in a house?
Yes, they will live quite happily because they put you as their pack. And this is what I mean about being the leader of the pack. Yes, I know beagles where they've taken over the house completely. But it's because the people have been a bit silly, and they can live quite happily as the owner dog, but there too is not as much trouble as one.
Because they keep themselves
company. They keep themselves company and they play with each other, and you know what I mean. It's the way they are.
Now, the other thing you hear about hounds is they've got this tremendous nose and they just follow it. So what is training like with a beagle, particularly that recall training? What's that like?
Patience and perseverance. And a handful of tidbits, because stomach overrules head with a beagle. And if you can have a pocket full of tidbits and you can watch them and see them going, you shout biscuits and turn the other way and go in the other direction, 9 times out of 10 they'll follow you.
That sounds like me, stomach rules head.
Yeah, it does, stomach rules head. It does. I loose mine, when I start with mine, I loose them on different lengths of rope, the soft sail rope. And I loose them on that so that I've got 12 foot of rope which I can put a foot on if I do think they're going to go, and stop them and give them a tip, get them back, give them a tidbit. A lot of it is the way you do it, to be quite honest. The way you do it. A lot of it is psychology.
Yeah. Now, last question. I know you've said they sort of put their humans as their pack. How do they interact with the family? Are they good with children? You know, are they a one-man dog? What are they like within the family?
They are a family dog, and they are marvellous with children. They're very gentle, very loving dog. They do tend to pick the best chair to sit on, and they will pick on one person's lap, and it's usually the soft touch. Oh, you're a soft touch, I'll sit on you. You know what I mean. But they are lovely with children. They really are. They're a children's dog, and I have no problems. Even strange children, you can say to them, you know, it's like here sometimes children come and we say, do you want to go in? Oh, can I? And they go in and the dogs just walk up and lick them.
That interview was conducted at Crufts in the Discover Dogs section. That's what the lady meant about children being able to go into the pen with the dogs. So there you go. There's no need to worry about beagles in the UK, because they can still get out and have fun with a bit of aniseed, and they make great family pets, as long as you can train that recall. A dog knows the places he is thrown food. African proverb. I said earlier that Merle's Door by Ted Kerasotti is not just Merle's life story. There's a lot of research included that is presented in a very accessible way. Merle's unusual character and experiences mark this book out as different. But I think a lot of dog lovers will find the wolf research that is cited extremely interesting.
Yeah, and when I began to write Merle's biography, I was really determined to not write only a memoir of someone whom I thought was a remarkable dog and individual and one of the great loves of my life, but also give people the background as to why the dog-human relationship has evolved as it has. And part of that was demonstrating that all the dogs who are alive today are genetically and psychologically gray wolves. They are descended from gray wolves. So a Pekingese, a Great Dane, they're both genetically just like a gray wolf and could interbreed with a gray wolf if the gray wolf so chose. This brings up very interesting ramifications for how we train and live with dogs. The going wisdom has been that one ought to be a very strong alpha to one's dog, because when we've watched wolves, captive wolves in zoos, it is often the alpha male that disciplines the group, eats first, runs the pack with an iron paw. However, during the last 10 or 15 years, particularly after the introduction of gray wolves to Yellowstone National Park, and researchers looking at wolves in the high Arctic, for example, up in Ellesmere Island, and being able to habituate them to their presence and watch them from just feet away, we've seen a very different aspect of wolf society emerge. And what we've seen is that the alpha male and the alpha female actually share decision-making and leadership of their pack about half and half. And then when their maturing pups become more than a year old, they start to delegate responsibility for running the pack to these teenage wolves, allowing them to choose whom to hunt, when to hunt, where to move the pack. In other words, they start giving them more freedom, just the way human parents give their teenagers more freedom when they start to mature. Well, this then changes, in my mind, how we ought to live with dogs. As a pup matures, we give that pup a little bit more control over its life, depending on where we live. If we live in a city, it will be much more difficult to give a dog its own dog door, let it come and go as it wishes. However, we can take that dog to a park that has off-leash hours, or to the seashore, or to the woods, where dogs are perhaps allowed off-leash, and let that dog start exploring on its own, reading the scent books of its world, the library of its world, so it can gain an education in the way that dogs can get, only can gain an education, and that's through their noses. If we do that and allow a dog to lead us around for a while instead of walking it on this lead and keeping it in a narrow corridor, I think we begin to see remarkable aspects of its personality begin to emerge, a kind of steadiness and competence and the ability to make decisions that's led me to believe that the differences between human consciousness and animal consciousness are far fewer than any of us have imagined.
Against this, you know, you've got the research, which is fascinating, but then we have this, which I have to say is, when you live with a dog, the description of the physical relationship between you and Merle is incredible. I listened to the book, and my daughter was in the car with me at one point, and she actually gasped, and she just went, it's like when Buddy comes up to you. And it is amazing how you manage to convey with just words, you know, how we interact with our dogs.
Yeah. I've always had this belief that dogs are beings from another culture, and they're simply speaking another language, just the way someone might be speaking Chinese, if you will. And they do it through their vocalizations, through the expressions in their eyes and on their faces, through the subtle changes in their body language, and through their tail flagging. And most of us, if we don't pay attention to this, just think of dogs as these dumb creatures who can bark and don't say very much. And yet, they have a great, great range of expression, just the way their ancestors, wolves, do. And the way you watch wolves get in a huddle in their pack, and they're whining at each other, and their faces are going, and their tails are wagging, and they're making plans about who to hunt. Let's go hunt those elk. Let's go hunt those bison. Well, dogs can communicate to us in the very same way, and it's just a matter of trying to pay attention and letting the dog express itself and going to where the dog wants to take us and see what's happening. And in this way, we build up our vocabulary of doggish, if you will, instead of English or Spanish. And all I did in the book was, after living with Merle for 13 and a half years, I simply translated what he was telling me in the conversations we had. And if the hundreds upon hundreds of emails that I've received are any indication, I haven't done anything extraordinary or new. I simply have done what many dog owners do with their dogs, and that's hold conversations with them. Mm. The dog-human relationship would not be as deep and long-lasting as it has been if the two species couldn't communicate to each other.
But do you, I mean, I will have conversations with Buddy, and sort of I will answer him as if he said something to me. And I have to say, my husband, who doesn't have the as close a relationship with him, will just laugh. And I do think non-dog owners don't get the fact that you sort of do communicate with them.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And either people get it or they don't, or as in any other practice, you need to pay attention and put in some time before you get good at it. It would be like, I once spent a bunch of time with Bushmen in Namibia, and I would go out with the women who were gathering plants, and we'd be walking in the Kalahari Desert, and they'd stop and go, "That's," you know, making those click noises, and that's all I could see was a little dry tendril, and they would dig down and there would be this great big melon and we'd go along a little bit more and there'd be another tiny little stalk, and they'd go, "That's that," and they'd dig down and there'd be this great tuber. Now, to me, I could not read the language of those plants. I had no practice in it, but for those women, they were reading a whole botanical language. Same thing with dogs. Either you put your time in and you learn it, or the dog seems to be obtuse and saying nothing.
I suppose that all dog owners would say the worst thing about having a dog is the lifespan is too short. And in the book, it's very touching where you tell us about Merle's illness and how you fought that with him, you know, with the acupuncture, with the massage and with the supplements. And you did sort of improve his quality of life and extend his life a lot, didn't you?
I did. And in this regard, again, I'm not cutting edge in any respect. There's tons of acupuncturists and homeopathic vets out there who are doing that sort of work, and I learn from them. But it's just like our health. We can take care of ourselves, eat a good diet, get exercise. We tend to live longer. So too with our dogs. And the book I'm working on right now, which is called Why Dogs Die Young and What We Can Do About It, addresses this very issue. Why do dogs only live so few years compared to us? And is there any way to extend their lives? And I've met some breeders now of Labradors whose labs live 16 and 18 years, which is quite unusual.
Yeah.
What is their secret? For one, they're not feeding typical commercial dog kibble, which has all sorts of terrible stuff in it. They're feeding their dogs either a very high grade of commercial dog food with organic ingredients, or they're cooking for their dogs themselves. They're really limiting the vaccinations they give their dogs, and there's a large segment of the veterinarian community that now feels that we're over-vaccinating our dogs, and this compromises their immune system, leading to all sorts of diseases, most notably cancer. The third thing that we can look at is environmental pollutants. And dogs have their noses in the ground. They walk bare-pawed. They don't have shoes on. And if we spray our lawns with chemicals, if we have a bunch of pesticides around the home, if we have carpeting that has a bunch of petrochemicals in it, our dogs are absorbing this chemical brew. And the fourth factor is inbreeding itself. There are a lot of dogs who suffer from genetic ailments that have been caused because we breed for certain conformations in dogs, and along with those conformations comes genetic fifth column that predisposes dogs to certain diseases like heart disease in King Cavalier Spaniels. So I've identified, by talking to vets and breeders, these four aspects that dog people can control and help their dogs to live longer lives.
Which would be a boon to all of us.
Yeah.
When Merle, you know, found you in the desert and sort of said, you know, you need a dog, I'm it, he definitely knew what he was doing, didn't he? Because you are so well matched. And, I mean, you tell a story about a couple who borrowed Merle. They were wondering about getting a dog and brought him back in disgust because he caught a grouse, hadn't he, and eaten it in front of them. And they sort of,
yes.
He found the right person, didn't he, with you?
He did. And I think he just smelled me. And we've read all these stories about how acute dog smells are and how... people have used them now to actually identify cancer in people. So there's Merle. He meets me. Here's a person who doesn't eat domestic meat, has a pretty healthy diet, eats a lot of elk and antelope and grouse, and I'm sure all his senses went kind of redlined, and he said to himself, here's someone who smells right. This might be a good person to hang out with. And I certainly think that was part of it. And also, I think dogs read our demeanor, our energy, with exquisite sensitivity. And I'm a pretty laid-back guy. I live in a rural place. I don't have huge amounts of stress in my life. And it's always seemed to me that dogs... all over the world, just like me. I don't know why that is, but everywhere I go, dogs come up to me and seem to really be at ease. Maybe I was a dog in my past lifetime. I don't know.
there's a part in the book where you're building your house and... mm-hmm. You ask the builder to lock the doors because it's such a novelty for a house to be built there. You know, people wander in and out. And you ask him to lock the doors, which he does, but you forget to mention the dog door. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the consequences of that?
Well, yes. As you mentioned, at that point, there was not a lot of new homes being built in Kelly. There still aren't. And so people, as the construction was going on, would just wander in, take a look around. And when the house was nearing completion and I had the floors, the wood floors, finished with polyurethane, I asked the floor finishers to lock the sliding doors on the patio and the front doors, but I forgot to ask them to lock to put the inserts in the dog door. So I came over to see how the floor looked, and I opened the front door, and there was this set of dog tracks coming out of the dog door, going across the great room to the fire, to the wood stove, over to the great big bay windows, the front windows, made a little clover leaf, and I looked up, and there was Merle on the balcony overlooking the great room with his head through the balusters, looking down at me and going, "This looks terrific." So I said, "Please come down here." And he whirled around. He came down, leaving another set of tracks through the not-dry polyurethane. And, I greeted him in the mudroom, and I said, "Ah, sir," I gave him a pet. "I'm glad it meets with your approval." So when the floors finally dried, I had the finishers come back and resand it and redo it, but I asked them to leave Merle's paw prints up on the balcony where he had stood looking down at me, so pleased. And they're still there today, overlooking the house he helped to build.
Yeah, yeah. I think above all else, this book is a love story, isn't it? It's yours and Merle's love story.
Yes. You know, I loved Merle to pieces, and I had never had a dog like that, and have not had many human friendships as deep and intimate as this one, as many readers have written me, close to 2,000. We have a bond with our dogs that sometimes exceeds in intimacy the ones we have with other humans, or it's of a different quality since we often get to spend all day with our dogs. And Merle and I certainly had that with the addition of enjoying a great deal of time in the outdoors and in wild places doing adventurous things. So when he passed away, I was heartbroken. It truly, writing what is our love story was my way of spending another 3 years with him. And I'm still getting to do that because I get to talk with folks like yourself and be on the book tour and answer readers' emails. So Merle is still with me every day. I see him often. I think that shall always be the case.
I do hope that Ted always has that sense of Merle with him. I listened to the audio version of the book, which is read excellently by Patrick Lawler. And it's a finalist for the Audio Publishers Association 2008 Audies Award, which will be announced on May the 30th, so fingers crossed. Do not call to a dog with a whip in your hand. African proverb. You may remember an appeal from listener Jim Martin, who had spotted a Jack Russell called Scout he really liked the look of on our breed profile pages, and he desperately wanted to locate a dog as similar looking as possible. Well, it seemed that no one could help, so Jim took things into his own hands, and the following is an extract from his emails. We were able to use a picture of your Scout to show breeders what we were looking for. As it turned out, we found someone that wasn't too far away from us. After we emailed her the picture of your Scout, she emailed us back pictures of 2 13-week-old Jack Russell puppies that she still had left from a litter of 5, and also pictures of the mum and dad. The pictures and description of the temperament and physical characteristics of the mum and dad and puppies from previous litters looked and sounded like what we were looking for. So, just before Christmas, we filled our car up with gas and went to check them out for ourselves. We liked what we saw and purchased one of the 2 females she had left for a very reasonable price. We also have a 12-year-old male Cocker Spaniel, so everyone recommended we got a female. We named her Scout, and she is quite a Girl Scout indeed. She was 13 weeks old when we got her and is almost 7 months now. The past 4 months with Scout has been quite an adventure, to put it mildly. There have been so many obstacles to overcome and experiences we have had that I could hardly put them all into words. A typical one was that it took us over a week to get her to go number one with a collar on, so we had to let her out to the bathroom without a collar and leash, and we live close to woods and a main road, and she's fast as lightning. That was fun. Another one was it took us around 3 months to be able to let her and our Cocker Spaniel run around together unsupervised. That was fun. The other thing is that I believe that everyone who has a Jack Russell should have, amongst other things, 2 basketballs, one full-size one for outside use and one mini-size one for inside use. One of our friends who knew someone who had Jack Russells told us that their Jack Russells loved to play with a basketball in their fenced backyard. So, even though we don't have a fenced yard, since we do have a long dog run cable which we use in combination with a flexi leash attached to it, we got the basketballs. We got a full-size basketball for Scout to try. She took to it right away. We were so successful with the full-size basketball outside, we decided to try a mini basketball inside. Scout took to it right away also. These 2 basketballs have improved our adventure with Scout by tenfold at least. She is an absolute riot chasing them. But the best part is that she can entertain herself playing with these balls, and we can get a break from the constant desire for attention that Scout has. A tired Jack Russell is much easier to put up with than a bored Jack Russell. Summing her up, I would say, our Girl Scout Jack Russell is an adorable pistol of a dog who, even though she is a handful to put it mildly, has stolen both of our hearts. Thank you for your help and kindness, and I just wanted to drop you a line to let you know our story had a happy ending. Well, Jim, I'm so happy that you found the dog you wanted, and you're having so much fun with her. And I'm so glad for her that she's found such a great home with you. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121 288 0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
What do you get when you cross an insomniac, an agnostic and a dyslexic? Someone who stays up all night wondering if there's a dog.